Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Zimbabwe's ruling party has given President Robert Mugabe until noon Monday to resign or face impeachment. It has installed the former Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who Mugabe dismissed 2 weeks earlier, as the party's new chief. Obert Mpofu is chairman of that emergency meeting.
Events that have unfolded in the last four weeks necessitate our meeting here today. The entire nation is excited that the Zimbabwe Defense Forces have taken a bold stand in defense of the Constitution and the right of the people of Zimbabwe to express their political opinions without fear or favor. Well done, Defense Forces.
The 93-year-old Mugabe met Sunday also with the army commander who put him under house arrest just days ago. Saad al-Hariri, who resigned as Lebanon's prime minister earlier this month, said he would return to Beirut Wednesday and explain his surprising resignation announcement in Saudi Arabia. Hariri spoke Saturday in Paris with French President Emmanuel Macron, who offered to help Hariri resolve his role in the bizarre Lebanese political drama. Longtime Venezuelan opposition leader Antonio Ledezma met with Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy in Madrid Saturday. He had arrived in Spain earlier in the day from Colombia after escaping house arrest in Caracas. Neither man spoke publicly about the meeting. Before leaving Colombia, Ledezma said he was planning a global pilgrimage to fight for political freedom in Venezuela. This is VOA News. A sign of hope for the families of the 44 crew members on board a missing Argentine naval submarine. On Saturday, the defense ministry said it believes it's detected 7 failed satellite calls from that vessel, a possible indicator that the crew has been trying to reestablish communications. Reuters' Sarah Hemrajani reports.
The location of the ARA San Juan hasn't been known since Wednesday, when it last made contact 268 miles off Argentina's southern Atlantic coast. Authorities in Argentina are now working on tracing the calls, while an international search mission is underway. But that's been complicated by recent stormy weather. The Navy says an electrical outage on the submarine may have been the cause of its problems.
Ukraine officials have arrested a man who was considered a suspect in the 2004 shooting death of Paul Klebnikov, the editor of the Russian edition of Forbes magazine. Ukraine State Security Service said in a statement that they had detained a suspect, a Russian man, who's also wanted in other slayings. He was arrested in Kiev. A stampede in southern Morocco left at least 15 people dead and 5 others injured Sunday as food aid was being distributed. That's according to the Ministry of Interior Ministry. The Associated Press reports that it happened as a local association was distributing food aid in a local weekly market. King Mohammed VI has given instructions that all measures be taken to help the victims and their families. The king will pay for the hospitalization of the wounded and the burials of the dead, according to the statement. A drought has greatly hurt agricultural output in Morocco, recently contributing to the high cost of basic food items. Hard rock band AC/DC co-founder Malcolm Young has died. Young created the Australian heavy metal band with his brother Angus in 1972. He had been suffering from dementia for several years. He was the group's guitar player until his illness forced him to leave from the band in 2014. Afghanistan defeated Pakistan Sunday, winning their first under-19 Cricket Asia Cup final in Kuala Lumpur, offering a rare opportunity for celebrations in a country desperate for a break from relentless rounds of deadly violence. Batting first, the Afghan team scored 248 runs in their allotted 50 overs. The opposition Pakistan side, while chasing the target, was dismissed within 23 overs for just 63 runs, enabling Afghans to win the match by a massive margin of 185 runs. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
I have not seen the people of Zimbabwe so happy since the time the MDC was formed in 1999 and the MDC galvanized in the referendum.
The Zimbabwean ruling ZANU-PF party dismisses President Robert Mugabe as its leader.
This is intolerable, not in any age, and especially on the fact that it is Africans being told by fellow Africans. And this, I think there's absolute a groundswell of unanimity.
The chairperson of the African Union Commission sharply condemns reports of the auctioning of African migrants in Libya.
For the investigation, it's normal that after something so grievous as this fire in the parliament building, there should be investigation.
And the Cameroonian government launches an inquiry into an overnight fire which destroyed much of the parliament's building. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Zimbabwean ruling ZANU-PF party dismissed President Robert Mugabe Sunday as leader and has installed formally sacked Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa as the party's new leader. Last week, Mugabe sacked Mnangagwa as Vice President of Zimbabwe. Leaders of the party also expelled Mugabe's wife Grace, leader of the ZANU-PF Women's League, from membership in the ruling party. The opposition's parliamentary chief whip Innocent Gonesi told the Associated Press that if Mugabe does not willingly step down as president, impeachment is a possibility. For reaction about the dramatic political development, I reached Rejoice Ngwenya, a Zimbabwean political analyst in the capital, Harare.
I have not seen the people of Zimbabwe so happy since the time the MDC was formed in 1999 and the MDC galvanized in the referendum. There is so much elation and excitement and ecstasy. You can't even touch it. I mean, if it was quantifiable, the quantum would be probably about 99 out of 100. There's so much, hope and optimism, Peter.
Why are people having so much hope and optimism? Because Emmerson Mnangagwa, until recently, was a close ally of President Robert Mugabe and a confidant who was the vice president, a crocodile, as some people affectionately call him. Why would you think anything would be different since basically they share the same ideology or school of thought?
Look, I mean, there is so much resentment about the Mugabe era that the general feeling on the ground is anything but Mugabe. And the second point is that people of Zimbabwe are generally forgiving by nature. The spirit of vengeance and revenge is not something the average Zimbabwean is gifted with. So, like I said, that, the people of Zimbabwe are committed to if Mugabe is going out of the political algorithm. And general sentiment is that anything but Mugabe, anything that is not Mugabe, or Morgan Tsvangirai, as long as it is Mugabe, they are prepared to deal with it in the future. For now, they are just excited about it.
Where is Grace Mugabe, who most people blame for the current situation in the country, or the headache that some people describe as Mugabe having? Why is he so quiet?
It's a good thing that, the order of things is silenced there. Although I don't want to kind of like agree with the general popular sentiment that Grace Mugabe is responsible, because Mugabe is a center of power and authority. So I don't think that he had totally lost his cognitive, capacity. But it is good that, Grace Mugabe has been made the subject matter of this revolution, and she has been silenced. And we just assume that, she must be either under house arrest, whatever, which country she is. The authorities within that country do not want to stir the political waters by revealing her presence.
Zimbabwe seemed to have been taken by surprise by the turn of events, how dramatic the military stepped in and the speed with which ZANU-PF expelled him as leader of the party. How are things moving at the moment, fluid as it is currently?
Basically, the engine of the economy, you know, whatever it is left of it, you know, these military guys that were smart enough not to tamper around with the, you know, the mechanics of the social economic environment. But as you say, you know, we are totally stunned. The pace of events and the transformation of events has been so fast that, you know, it is taking time for people to wake up. The crowds that were there yesterday and the surrealism that surrounds the whole thing, I can tell you that no Hollywood script writer could have been able to capture that. For the time being, people are in total denial. They can't believe that this thing is happening. So perhaps when reality sets in, there's going to be more qualitative you know, emotions around it.
Some people are saying they waited 37 years for this. Others are also saying that there will be a new face at the African Union Summit next year. What say you?
Well, I mean, do you know that one of the major, you know, elements or the catalyst for this whole, you know, populist, you know, activity around Mugabe's exit has been to show the SADC and AU that they are being conned by the Mugabe machinery to say the people of Zimbabwe are behind Mugabe. So I believe really whatever is going to transpire in SADC or AU will never lend legitimacy to Mugabe's continued perpetuated stay in power. So for the time being, I would say the people of Zimbabwe really do not care much about the happenings within SADC and the AU because they feel that these two institutions have been trying to be protective of Mugabe. So they are kind of the institutions that Zimbabweans, for now, really, they don't want to hear about.
Rejoice Ngwenya is a Zimbabwean political analyst. She spoke with me from Harare. The chairperson of the African Union Commission has sharply condemned reports of the auctioning of African migrants in Libya as slaves. Moussa Faki Mahamat demands an immediate end to their practices and other criminal acts of human trafficking. The chairman has since called on the Libyan authorities to take quick action to identify all perpetrators and accomplices with a view to bringing them to justice. Chairman Faki also said the continental body will not be deterred in its determination to help bring the practice to an end and to ensure the respect of human rights. For more reaction, I reach Ebba Kalondu, spokesperson for the African Union in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
I think everybody, the entire African continent, including the African Union, of course, and its member states, are united in absolute shock and horror that Africans are being sold by fellow Africans in this day and age. So this is intolerable, not in any age, and especially on the fact that it is Africans being sold by fellow Africans. And this, I think there's absolute a groundswell of unanimity in terms of reaction, as you call it, not only from the African Union, but from our individual member states.
Will the African Union Commission send envoys to Libya to investigate this and possibly find out who are behind these acts?
Two things. I think the African Union, of course, as you might have known, came out with a statement yesterday on that, and that the chairperson of the commission intends to quickly dispatch an envoy to Libya for consultations with the government of Libya and other stakeholders to agree on practical steps to address not only the plight of African migrants in Libya in general, but also to make sure that there is an investigation into these criminal acts. And we look forward to a credible outcome from the Libyan authorities to identify the perpetrators and their accomplices with a view to bring them to justice, of course.
Will the African Union support quick, decisive prosecution of the mastermind if the investigation identify those who are complicit in this?
This is obvious. I think not only the African Union, but all our member states and the world at large demands for a quick investigation that identifies and prosecutes these perpetrators and their accomplices to end this type of practice in Libya. The African Union is not the first time we've discussed this issue with the different Libyan authorities about the treatment of sub-Saharan African migrants in Libya, but I think at this point the issue has become urgent for Libyan authorities, wherever they might be, and no matter which territories that they control, that these perpetrators be brought to justice immediately.
Some people are saying that statement by both African Union Commission Chairman Moussa Faki and Professor Alpha Condé, the chairperson of the African Union, don't go far enough. They wanted decisive action. They wanted at least something harsh to be done to address this once and for all. Do you think their criticisms are justified?
I think everybody is justified in this feeling of helplessness and absolute horror and anger, which we all share, including the African Union. So that the fact that there is this groundswell of calls for decisive action and immediate prosecution is what we all want. I think what is important to note, however, is that Libya is a fractured state. There is no central government. There are various authorities who control various areas. Tripoli is under one type of authority. So this is going to be a very complex operation. But I think with the fact that there is such a unanimity of revulsion and call towards action, including together with the African Union, I think that this groundswell for decisive action now will propel not only the continent, but all member states and the world to make sure that this issue is dealt with decisively in Africa by Africans and its partners.
What is the message of the African Union regarding this report to the people and authorities in Libya?
This is not an unfortunate incident, Peter. This is criminal. This is unheard of. And this is an affront to all Africans, past and present, and for everything that we stand for as the African Union Commission and all our member states. What we are calling for those authorities who control any territory of Libya, as Africans, as human beings, they have a moral duty by charter and by humanity to make sure that there is no trafficking of human beings on this continent, in this world, today.
Eba Kalondo is the spokesperson for the African Union Commission. She spoke with me from Addis Ababa. The Cameroonian government has launched an investigation into an overnight fire which destroyed much of Parliament's building in the capital Yaoundé Thursday. There were no reported casualties or deaths. The administration says the fire was caused by an accident, though there were concerns about possible foul play. Information Minister Issa Chiroma Bakari says investigations have been opened into the cause of the fire that destroyed four floors of the seven-story building. Joseph Banerjee, parliamentary leader of the main opposition party, the Social Democratic Front, or SDF, told me that the documentation of the party's 20 years in parliament, as well as his family's personal property and those of the staff, were destroyed in the fire.
For the investigation, it's but normal that after something so grievous as this fire in the parliament building, there should be investigation. So I don't know in what manner they are taking place, but it is normal, and we expect the investigation to give us some conclusions.
I also understand that a whole bunch of documentation of the Social Democratic Front appears to have been lost forever. How truthful is this?
This is very, very true. The Social Democratic Front, the SDF, has been in parliament for 22 years. Now. And all our documentation, all material that concerns the life of the SDF in Parliament was in this office. And all this has been consumed completely, totally by fire, either in electronic form or in paper form or whatever material we had, all of it has been completely destroyed.
What about your office? I understand your office seems to have been destroyed as well in the fire.
Yeah, the whole place, my office and every personal thing, everything. Of course, you understand that when you have an office, like I've been in that office for 10 years, you tend to have personal belongings in it. You tend to look at it that it is secure. The assembly building is well protected. You have guards all over. There are cameras, as I said earlier. And any normal person would think that that is a safe place for where you can keep certain precious property. All of it, for myself and for the staff that is in my office, seven of them, many of them had their certificates in there. My children's property, precious things, we kept them handy in that place. So all of it has all been lost.
There are people who are expressing concern that this could possibly be arson. Others are blaming or claiming that it is the secessionist Ambazonians who are to blame for this. There are speculation that possibly it could have been an electrical fault. What is your assessment?
Personally, I think it could be an electrical problem. It could be a cause of an accident, either a short circuit or an AC blowing off and so on. As I said, people are filtered before they get into parliament. There are guards all over. And at the time this took place by 10 o'clock in the evening, any persons that could have filtered in would have left the building before that time. And if somebody tampered with anything that could cause a fire, that would be seen before, and you could not leave it indefinitely from 7 o'clock when people would have left to 10 o'clock when the fire breaks out. That, so for me, when I look at circumstances, I tend to get more of some electrical problem, some accident than personal or individual things.
Now that you don't have offices, what are you going to do?
We did clearly indicate that we were boycotting the opening session of the National Assembly and that we will be taking part in all activities and presenting the SDF because it would be a honor for us fight the system and not be there to fight it. In fact, on Monday, we are supposed to have a meeting to assess the various meetings which we had, because after our boycott of the opening session, we had a series of top meetings with the Speaker of the National Assembly, with the Minister in charge of relations with the Assembly, with the President of the Senate, with the Secretary General of the CPDM, to express our worries, what made us to boycott the opening session. In fact, the fact that our populations were being harassed and brutalized, we wanted to draw their attention that they should do something to arrest that. And with all the meetings we have met, we will have another meeting to assess all these meetings and the way forward. That is on Monday morning at our party secretariat. So it tells you that we will still function from somewhere, even if it is not from the National Assembly.
Joseph Banajem is the parliamentary leader of the Cameroonian main opposition party, the Social Democratic Front, or SDF. He spoke with me from Yaoundé. Officials from four South Sudanese states have agreed to allow free movement of their pastoralist communities and their cattle from one area to another at a four-day conference in Bor. They also resolved to share water points and grazing land for their animals during the dry seasons. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Bor.
Pastor Paul from Akobo leads a closing prayer in his native Nuer language at the end of the conference held in Jonglei State's Duk Padiet County yesterday. During the conference, officials and community leaders talked about issues related to border conflict and the movement of pastoralists, goods and services across the borders of the four states, three of which were kept out of the original Jonglei State by President Salva Kiir. Jonglei State Governor Philip Aguirre described the resolutions reached at the end of the conference.
All the participants agreed that the people of Jonglei State have the right and privilege to share water, to share grazing land. They have put down rules and regulations that will govern the sharing of resources water and grazing land. And the most important is the formation of community police that will be accompanying the cattle camps in the torches, formation of a border and mobile court.
Aguirre says the four governors also agrees to eliminate any and all illegal taxations by border guards in the four states.
When traders leave Juba with food item, they are illegally taxed on the road, and we have agreed that the ministers of finance and the revenue authorities should have to meet immediately in Bor on the 7th of December to discuss the issues of illegal taxation that is affecting the causes of food prices in the regions like Bia and Akobo and Fangak.
Akobo State Deputy Governor John Huyal says food insecurity contributes to insecurity across the greater Jonglei area. He called on humanitarian agencies to deliver assistance to all parts of the region.
If the humanitarian have access to all four states, I think security will be secure.
Pangak State Governor John Kung Nguyen says a majority of residents in all the state rely on livestock for their livelihoods. Nguyen says authorities should not allow border disputes over livestock to cause conflict. James Odong, Project Director for Catholic Relief Services in Jonglei State, says his agency organized the conference to help communities in the four states to address those kinds of issues so all residents can peacefully coexist.
All development efforts in this country, rolling it out to a larger scale, can never be achieved without peace dividend. And we do believe that a meeting like this that brings people together to talk to each other, to have a meaningful conversation, will lay a foundation for such to happen, for development to take place in this nation.
Cattle raids and child abductions in these parts of the country are commonplace and have led to several deaths in Greater Jonglei over the past decade. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
Next year marks the 100th anniversary of the deadliest flu pandemic in recorded history. More people lost their lives in the 1918 flu pandemic than in World War I. VOA's Carol Pearson reports, although scientists have made headway in controlling a number of diseases, influenza is one that still eludes them.
Each year, scientists make a flu vaccine. That's their best guess about what strain of the virus will be circulating the following year. Dr. Anthony Fauci, an infectious disease expert at the National Institutes of Health, says although the vaccine prevents hospitalizations and deaths, it's not ideal.
Even on a good year, the overall efficacy of an influenza vaccine is about 60%. So even though it is always better to get vaccinated against influenza than it is not to get vaccinated, no doubt about that, we need to get a better vaccine.
Several years ago, the vaccine's effectiveness was a dismal 10%. Compare that to the vaccines for measles and yellow fever, which are almost completely effective, and the vaccine for polio, which protects 90% of those who get it. Even manufacturers of flu vaccines are dissatisfied. Dr. David Vaughn is the director of vaccine research and development at pharmaceutical giant GSK.
The disease we're trying to prevent is very prevalent. Up to 20% of us will have an influenza infection during the course of a year.
There's now better treatment for pneumonia and other complications of the flu, but doctors are concerned about another deadly pandemic, like the one in 1918 that claimed 50 million lives worldwide. We asked Dr. Fauci if there could be another deadly pandemic like that one.
Certainly, we've had a flu pandemic in 2009, the H1N1 swine flu, that was not a serious epidemic in the sense of a lot of deaths. It was a pandemic, to be sure, because it was a relatively new virus that was widespread infection throughout the world.
Researchers have found that part of the influenza virus doesn't change from year to year, which may help them produce a vaccine that's more effective. Vaughn says the World Health Organization considers this a high priority.
Most influenza deaths occur in developing countries, and very few vaccinations occur there.
Until a universal influenza vaccine is available, more lives can be saved if more people start getting the imperfect seasonal flu vaccine. Not only can this prevent the spread of the virus, but it lowers the risk of a deadly pandemic, like the one in 1918. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The draw for the 2018 African Nations Championship, CHAN, was made in Rabat on Friday night, with Nigeria grouped alongside Libya, the only former winners in the 16 teams taking part. The tournament, which is for African footballers based in their own domestic leagues, will be staged in Morocco between January 12th and February 4th next year. The Nigerians are making a third consecutive appearance in the biennial event and will also face Rwanda and Equatorial Guinea in their group. Nigeria finished third in 2014 in South Africa but failed to reach the knockout phase in Rwanda last year. Rwanda were the last qualifiers for Morocco 2018, winning a playoff against Ethiopia last weekend after Egypt withdrew because top clubs were not prepared to release players. Equatorial Guinea are debutants and qualified without kicking a ball after opponents Gabon withdrew from the regional qualifying competition. Namibia, Uganda and Zambia were placed in a group with Ivory Coast, who came third last year, behind champions the Democratic Republic of Congo and runners-up Mali. Uganda will be desperate to at least reach the quarterfinals after three first-round exits in a row, while the best showing from Zambia was third at the first tournament in 2009. Namibia are the other debutants after shocking Zimbabwe in a qualifier despite fielding a rusty squad because of the lack of domestic football. Morocco, the second choice as hosts after Kenya fell behind with preparations, meet 2016 semi-finalist Guinea, Sudan and Mauritania. The other group is made up of 2011 runners-up Angola, Cameroon, Congo-Brazzaville, and Burkina Faso. The winning nation will win $1.25 million, up from the $750,000 DR Congo received in Kigali last time out. Meanwhile, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has agreed to move next year's Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers to October to allow the continent's World Cup finalists to play friendlies in March. Nigeria, Senegal, Egypt, Tunisia, and Morocco are the five African teams for Russia 2018. The 2019 Africa Cup of Nations will now be played in June 2019 as against January. And in athletics, the World Anti-Doping Agency maintained its suspension of Russia on Thursday, raising the possibility of a ban from February's Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang. WADA's Foundation Board meeting in Seoul came to the decision after its Compliance Review Committee recommended that Russia's anti-doping body, RUSADA, should not be reinstated. The International Olympic Committee is expected to decide whether Russia can compete in Pyeongchang at an executive board meeting next month in Lausanne. And Ethiopia's Bihanu Legese and Almaz Ayana took the honors at the Airtel Daily Half Marathon, crossing the line in 59.46 and 1 hour 7 minutes and 11 seconds respectively, to win the IAAF Gold Labour Road Race on Sunday. Legese, now 23, regained the title he won 2 years ago after pulling away from four rivals in the first 500 metres. Teenager compatriot Admalak Belihu followed Legese home and clocked 59.51 on his debut over the distance. Despite having to settle for a second on this occasion, it was still a stunning performance from Belihu, who turns just 19 on Monday. Leonard Korir finished third in 59.52, the second fastest time ever by a U.S. runner, and just 9 seconds shy of the North American record. Also, Sammy Kiprop Kitwara set a massive Spanish all-comers record at the Marathon Valencia Trinidad Alfonso in the eastern Spanish city on Sunday. The 31-year-old Kenyan produced a 2-hour, 5 minutes and 15 seconds effort to finish almost a full minute inside the previous record, moving 7th on this year's world list in the process. Ethiopia's Aberu Mekuria Zenebe won the women's race in 2 hours, 26 minutes and 17 seconds to improve on her 4th-placed finish from last year. The 33-year-old finished almost a minute ahead of Birlashan Vola Mazronak. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Que nenhum encaixa no meu. Baby, esse beijo é demais. O que o teu corpo faz, mais nenhum faz. Derretes todo o gelo em mim. Não sei viver sem ti. Segue a melodia, ah, deixa-te guiar, ah. Tu és perfeito, não te meto um defeito. Só te quero fazer feliz. Já te magoei, nunca quis. Ai, amore, calorei. Tanta boca pra beijar, eu só quero a tua. Tanto corpo pra me amar, eu só quero o teu. Tanto olhar por aí, que me quer fazer feliz. Não sei bem o que me deu, mas tudo em mim é só teu. Deixa-te pegar pra dançar, segue o meu passo, deixa-te levar. Esse teu jeito é singular. Ninguém tem essa tua forma de me amar. Teu toque me faz arrepiar. Beijar a tua boca me faz sonhar. Só tu, baby. Não tem como tu, baby. Eu quero ser só tua e te levar pra lua. Tanta boca pra beijar, eu só quero a tua. Esquece o mundo e vai. Esquece o mundo e vai. Tanta boca pra beijar, eu só quero beijar. Tanto corpo, tanto.
Camus não inventou palavras para exprimir esse momento. Anjos aplaudem nosso amor, nossa felicidade, nossa alegria. Até Deus sorriu para nós. Nuvens formaram nossa imagem no céu, no céu. Coração explode pela boca e a nossa voz fica rouca. De tanto gritar te amo, de tanto gritar te amo. E o nosso amor é lindo, e o nosso amor é lindo. E nos faz feliz. Mas o mundo nos chama loucos, porque falamos sozinho na rua. Nos chamam loucos, porque contamos estrelas no céu. Nos chamam loucos, porque tatuamos nossa imagem no coração. Mas o mundo nos chama loucos, porque falamos sozinho na rua. Nos chamam loucos, porque contamos estrelas no céu. Nos chamam loucos, porque tatuamos nossa imagem no coração. E cai neve em todas as estações, e até no rádio dedicam-nos canções. O mundo rendeu-se ao nosso sorriso. Somos exemplo do paraíso. Formamos um par perfeito, formamos um par perfeito. E a nossa chama se espalha, o sorriso encontra. Como é doce o beijo, como é doce o beijo. Uou, 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 uou. Como é doce o beijo. Mas o mundo nos chama loucos, porque falamos sozinho na rua. Nos chama loucos, porque contamos estrelas no céu. Nos chamam loucos, porque tatuamos nossa imagem no coração. Mas o mundo nos chama loucos, porque falamos sozinho na rua. Nos chamam loucos, porque contamos estrelas no céu. Nos chamam loucos, porque tatuamos nossa imagem no coração.
Oh, I'm balling for two. Let nobody do me better in truth. See, I'm balling for two. Let nobody do me better in truth. With the bad musician, plus the bad producer. You already know, we on every show. Ola wale, amen. Wale wale, amen. Maserati, Ferrari, amen. Ferragamo, Bugatti, amen. Ola wale, amen. Wale wale, amen. Maserati, Ferrari, amen. Ferragamo, Bugatti. So easy, baby, loke, loke. Shabalo, shayo. Oh, oh, wale wale. Shabalo, shayo. Lagos today and London tomorrow. Shabalo, shayo. Oh, my day, day. If you call a woman Africa woman, no go green. If you call a woman Africa woman, no go green.
Do
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. It is profoundly sad and a folly that ardent opponents and detractors of President Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe have allowed themselves to be blinded by their desire to remove him from office, that they are ignoring the central issue now in Zimbabwe. The intervention of the military to resolve an inter-party dispute is totally unacceptable. Accordingly, the thousands of Zimbabweans who are now marching on the streets of Zimbabwe and calling and thanking the military for its intervention and celebrating the end of this Mugabe era will rule this day someday when the oxes being gored are their oxes. When the military coup began in Africa, by the coup against Olympio in Tokyo in January 1963 and was followed thereafter by the coup in Nigeria in January 1966 and then the next month in Ghana, there were those who believed this was a corrective action in Africa. They were wrong. Military coups have an epidemic effect. And we have seen in Africa numerous coup d'etats, over 40, and military coups have been a bane on the political, social, and economic progress of the continent. It is therefore commendable that the African Union and SADC have stated conclusively that no unconstitutional change of government is acceptable. It is true that the military in Zimbabwe has been very resourceful. They have not set aside the constitution of the country. They have not set parking the legislatures. In fact, they have said that they consider Mugabe still their commander-in-chief. They have said their only concern is to remove those corrupt peoples around Mugabe, something which should be more of a police action. But one must not forget that the Zimbabwe military have said over and over again that they would not tolerate any president in Zimbabwe who is not from the ranks of the veterans. And when they saw the dismissal of their candidate, Mnangagwa, and see the possibility of a so-called G40 group ascending, they have fulfilled their threats. The Zimbabwe army is not intervening to promote democracy and good governance in Zimbabwe. They are intervening to protect their interests. Like in Egypt, the military in Zimbabwe have enormous economic interests in the country, and that's what they are trying to protect. So it is foolhardy for people to be celebrating this disease of military intervention in Africa. One must watch carefully that nothing is done to give any encouragement to other military outside Africa. The copycat effect should be watched carefully, because if it succeeds in Zimbabwe, you can be assured it will be copied throughout the continent. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America.
Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the hunter does not rub himself in oil and lie by the fire to sleep. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Over the past few years, the global community has dealt severe, even debilitating defeats to some of the most high-profile terrorist organizations around the globe. Nonetheless, terrorism still poses an existential threat to many states around the world. One of the lesser-known but nonetheless effective tools against radicalization and terrorism is foreign aid. It's not just about delivery of direct or humanitarian aid, supporting global democracy and civil rights, stabilizing post-conflict areas and post-disaster areas, and helping the displaced return to their homes are all effective means of countering terrorism. And this is where the United States Agency for International Development comes in. Our development initiatives address conditions which, left unchecked, can lead to the kind of frustration and despair that transnational criminal organizations and terrorist groups often try to exploit, said USAID Administrator Mark Green in recent testimony before a House Appropriations Subcommittee. USAID works to ease the life of displaced families and the communities that host them, countering the conditions that often drive mass migration, said Administrator Green. We also work to repair the fabric of countries and communities torn apart by conflict and war in ways that will hopefully solidify military success. In particular, we know helping the most vulnerable and the most targeted has to be a big part of this strategy, he said. USAID cooperates with other agencies and international partners to resolve more complex problems. For example, the agency supports the U.S. Department of Defense in its efforts to stabilize Raqqa so its citizens can return to their homes. And the Department of Defense, in return, supports USAID's disaster relief response teams as they work to aid the victims of hurricanes, earthquakes, or other natural disasters. USAID plays a key role in the interagency international strategy to prevent and mitigate the threat of infectious disease outbreaks, epidemics, and antimicrobial resistance under the global health security agenda. We help counter illicit activities from trafficking in persons to trafficking in wildlife, which criminal and terrorist organizations often leverage to fund their operations, said Administrator Green. Because responding to the growing number of humanitarian crises is a core part of American global leadership, we are working to elevate and refine our humanitarian assistance efforts.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.